This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, January 12th, 2021. I'm Antoine Grajeda. Ahead this hour, the Arkansas legislative session is officially underway. Roby Brock from Talk Business and Politics and political columnist John Brummett reflect on the first day of the session in their weekly conversation. And we learn how the Arkansas Public Policy Center plans to keep Arkansans educated about the session as it progresses, as well as redistricting efforts following the 2020 census. After Ozarks at Large on Here and Now, with just over a week to go in his administration, calls for President Trump to resign or be removed from office continue after last week's assault on the Capitol. Also, states are struggling to get enough of the coronavirus vaccine into enough arms. That's next time on Here and Now, today at 1, right after this edition of Ozarks at Large. The number of Arkansans in the hospital because of COVID-19, as well as the number of patients on ventilators, set records yesterday. The Arkansas Department of Health reports 1,371 people are hospitalized and 268 of them are on ventilators. Both represent increases of 31 patients in their respective categories. Nearly 1,300 more Arkansans have tested positive for the virus, and another 38 have died. Active cases now number more than 256,000 across the state. The counties with the most new cases are Benton with 154, Washington with 149, Pulaski with 146, Sebastian with 86, and Garland with 69. Students have returned to class following the winter holiday break, and the Department of Health is reporting thousands of active cases at school districts across the state. According to ADH's latest report on educational institutions, which was released Monday, there are 3,280 active cases at public schools. That's 77 fewer than ADH's previous report last Thursday. Meanwhile, the University of Arkansas announced 52 new positive cases yesterday as classes resumed for the spring semester. Officials report a total of 109 active cases, which include all individuals who may have been on campus since January 1st. The governor will give his weekly update on the pandemic at 1:30 this afternoon. You can listen live here on KUAF. We'll also have highlights from the briefing tonight at 7 on our evening edition of Ozarks at Large. Community action agencies across the state are now accepting applications for the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP. As Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek tells us, program administrators are expecting more people will apply for assistance as many continue to struggle financially during the pandemic.
The Washington County Economic Opportunity Agency is one of 15 community action agencies in Arkansas that started taking LIHEAP applications on Monday. Delia Anderson Farmer is the organization's executive director.
The Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, it provides help to low-income households that need help with their energy bills, whether it's electricity, gas, propane, or wood.
Anderson Farmer says any resident of Washington County who is in need of assistance should start by going to the EOA website, which lists all the documents that have to be submitted with their application. That includes a photo ID, social security numbers, and birth dates for all household members, electric and gas or propane bills, and proof of income or job loss.
We also interview our applicants, and we are not providing in-person assistance right now due to COVID. We're only conducting interviews over the phone.
So applicants should submit all their information first and then call the EOA to set up a time for an interview.
It depends on whether they are up to date on their bill or if they're what we call being in crisis. They are past due. So all of those factors are looked into before we can determine how much someone can receive in assistance.
Right now, Anderson Farmer says the EOA has about $900,000 in LIHEAP funding to give away throughout the year for both their winter and summer energy programs, which is about the same amount the agency received in 2020. So financial assistance will be available until the money runs out.
It's typically a one-time benefit. Unless somebody gets into a crisis situation, then they can come back and apply again.
Anderson Farmer expects the number of applicants to be higher than usual because of the pandemic.
Even though the utility suppliers, major utility suppliers, I should clarify, are not disconnecting energy right now, but still, people are in crisis situations. We also have people that have not received assistance from us before. This is the first time they've had to reach out for help because they're not working right now or they've had reduced hours.
Aside from LIHEAP, the EOA can also help Fayetteville, Springdale, and Taneytown water customers with those bills.
Customers of those water utility providers who are in need of water utility assistance, we encourage them to call our main number and schedule an appointment with us. There is also an application on our website with the documents that need to be submitted along with the application.
As far as rental assistance, Anderson Farmer says at this point, it's not guaranteed the agency will get any additional funding other than the $212,000 that had already been appropriated by the state legislature back in November for phase two of the Arkansas Fresh Start program.
We did continue to process some of the applications for people who were on the wait list in anticipation of receiving the second round of funding, and that was promised to us in December. But we're still waiting. So our hats go off to the landlords who have been really patient with us throughout this process. We've let them know that there has been a delay and we're expecting the funds to come through for those applications that we've already processed any day now.
Anderson Farmer says the EOA received hundreds of applications from tenants who are behind on their rent. So while phase two of the funding has yet to be made available, it's already been spoken for.
But we're hoping that there will be some opportunities in Washington County to help residents here, whether it's through EOA or other organizations to help with rental assistance, because that is a high need right now.
Although there's no rental assistance available at the moment, Anderson Farmer encourages residents who are struggling financially to apply for utility assistance.
And if you can get some type of relief during that month to free up some of your funds that you have coming in for other priorities, then this is what this is about.
Residents of Benton, Madison, and Carroll counties can apply for LIHEAP assistance through Our Healthy Communities. And those living in Sebastian and Crawford counties can apply through the Crawford-Sebastian Community Development Council. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Susanna Sitek.
You can find the links to all the organizations mentioned in this story on our website, ozarksatlarge.com.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Arcom Plus, serving Northwest Arkansas for over 30 years. Arcom Plus offering printing, binding, graphic design, promotional items, and more. PrintingNWA.com or 444-7711 for more.
The Arkansas Legislature convened for the 93rd General Assembly yesterday, and some members already have an idea about which legislation they will support over the next few months. In an interview with our content partner KUAR in Little Rock, House Minority Leader Tippi McCullough, a Democrat from Little Rock, said she expects to see bipartisan support on some issues, including an already filed hate crimes bill, which has the backing of Governor Asa Hutchinson.
Many of us are certainly already co-sponsors on that bill and believe that it's needed, and we'll certainly work together on that. I think there are a lot of tax plans that are going to come through that we're going to have to look at, and don't know if there's any of those that we'll agree on. But if there is, that would of course be incredible. And I think surely there's some COVID-19 issues that we can, I think, in hindsight, you know, be much better prepared for and come together on.
In addition to hate crimes legislation, which has already accrued opposition from some Republicans, one bill that McCullough says will see opposition from Democrats will be a Stand Your Ground bill. Speaking to House members after he was unanimously reelected Speaker, Representative Matthew Shepard, a Republican from El Dorado, spoke on the COVID-19 pandemic, saying he believes it has reminded many lawmakers, quote, that an individual's worth does not equate to their net worth.
The Arkansans who we have relied on the most this year are the ones who have asked the least in return, and they live in every one of your districts. Ask yourself as you begin to create new legislation how it makes life better for those who have made your lives easier.
Amid a worsening pandemic, the issue of masks brought heated debate in the Senate. A rule was approved requiring face coverings, but Senator Stephanie Flowers, a Democrat from Pine Bluff, proposed an amendment penalizing anyone who fails to wear one at all times by docking per diem payments.
I believe that we have a requirement to wear a mask. And if some of us don't take it serious, and others do, I think we need to be protected from one another, from those that don't take it serious. I take it serious. I have an aunt that's in a hospital right now with COVID. I know others that have died from COVID. Members in this body have suffered from COVID.
But Senator Alan Clark, a Republican from Lonsdale, spoke against the amendment.
Just a few minutes ago, as I was being sworn in, my mask slipped down below my nose twice. The first time I took my hand down, pulled it up. The second time I was going to, and I noticed that Justice Kemp's had also, as he was talking, had slipped down below his nose. And I have to tell you, as serious as I take this, I don't take the mask as serious, but I take your health seriously and I take your feelings seriously.
Another Republican, Senator Trent Garner of El Dorado, made a point of taking his mask off while speaking and throwing it onto a podium. On a voice vote, the chamber rejected the amendment.
All in favor for the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All that are opposed, say no.
No!
I rule the noes have it.
The mask requirement will be in place, but without any form of punishment for violations. The legislature reconvened this morning for Governor Hutchinson's State of the State address. We'll have highlights from his speech on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large. The first day of the 93rd General Assembly included some appointments by the Speaker of the House, as well as the installment of lawmakers. What did and did not happen during the first day of the session was the focus of this week's conversation between Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business and Politics and John Brummett, a political columnist for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. They began their discussion by addressing a potential controversy over House District 32, which includes a portion of Pulaski County. Republican Representative Jim Sorvillo has been challenging the results of November's election after he was narrowly defeated by Democrat Ashley Hudson.
There was some potential controversy that we thought was going to erupt that did not erupt there. Let's begin with that controversy of seating Democratic Representative Ashley Hudson. There was a lot of chatter among Republicans to not do that. And in the end, there was no motion made. So crisis averted, I suppose. What would it have been like if we'd had a day one questioning of seating a House member like this? It would have been pretty unprecedented, wouldn't it?
It would have been unprecedented. It would have been quite horrible. I mean, merit aside, they nearly got in a fist fight in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives over this very kind of thing. Disputed certified election returns and seating of a Democrat. And they have enough Democrats up there in Pennsylvania to put up your dukes. They don't have enough in Arkansas to put up their dukes if they were to have fisticuffs. Then, of course, if you want to talk about, which I don't, Republicans challenging certified election returns, we could invoke last week's insurrection in the U.S. Capitol. And did we really want to have a very small microcosmic excuse for that in Arkansas, not to overstate, but did they want to go there at all? In the end, I think not. This election, it's unfortunate. Ashley Hudson won by what, 24 votes?
Right.
There are 27 votes they meant to throw out. They put into the count, but her opponent Cervillo went to court, lost. Went to the Claims Commission, lost, had an opportunity to produce proof that the 27 votes would affect the outcome, was unable or unwilling to try or unwilling to do so. So as a It's just, it's imperfect. It's unfortunate. But there's a Republican House member or incumbent who got reelected by fewer votes by similar circumstance. So it's all is well that ends well. And a routine seating of the entire delegation was just what the doctor ordered.
All right. Let's talk about down in the Senate end. We had a little bit of a controversy over wearing masks down there. Senator Stephanie Flowers, Senator Trent Garner, Senator Alan Clark, all known to spar from time to time.
They have gotten into it, yes.
Already on day one. What does that say about where we're going in this session?
Well, if you told me I could only cover one committee of the legislature this session, that would be the Senate Judiciary Committee, because that's where the incomparable Senator Stephanie Flowers, who can express her passion and anger from a left of center persuasion beautifully, can hold court. But now she's in an extreme minority because Trent Garner and Bob Ballinger and Clark, they've got five votes on there. And that's where the hate crimes thing goes. That's where stand your ground goes. So they're going to tangle. They're all quite mercurial in their style. I didn't think it would start the first day, but it did. Flowers wanted a rule that you got to wear your mask everywhere, including in the Senate quiet room, which is where they all go to be important and to be comfortable. And she wanted to take a day of per diem off of what you collected in terms of taxpayer money, and that was described as too harsh. I understand how all this happened. I don't want to make too much of it. I just want to say, if you cannot, you got to laugh to keep from crying. And on this one, for a senator to sacrifice a day of per diem was said to be too harsh a penalty for his insisting on breathing a potential deathly virus on his colleagues. That's sort of what, I think that's what extreme conservatism is right there in a nutshell. We've seen entirely too much of it in the last few days. Even so, came to nothing. Mask wearing will be generally required. And if a couple of these extreme right-wing senators want to not wear one, they can still keep their per diem. And again, all is well.
Yeah, the Senate did pass a mask requirement. They just did not make any penalties kind of attached to it there.
Right.
So let's shift to Washington, D.C. We had a tumultuous week last week with the mob that rioted at the U.S. Capitol. Now we have impeachment articles filed as of today in the House of Representatives, not only for against the president for inciting this mob, but also for his role in that released phone call to the Secretary of State of Georgia. Where do you think all this goes?
I believe. Well, I don't know to start. To first answer, I don't know. I believe the article of impeachment will be passed in the House with not many Republicans or any Wednesday. I think either Pelosi will hold it because McConnell will have already said he's not going to move it. There's not time. Or they'll send it to the Senate and McConnell will move it. And the issue will be whether the new Senate takes it up after he's gone, which will be a matter of high curiosity and controversy. After Trump has left office routinely, why would you then push to impeach him? Well, to make a statement that that leading an insurrection against the country and our democratic institutions is not acceptable, and also to keep him, from running again. Or being that kind of threat. So we'll see. That's the unknown. I think the impeachment's going to happen. Senate's not going to deal with it, I don't think, right away. What happens? And does Joe Biden, poor Joe, is he going to be the president who's trying to advance an agenda and try to reform the way we deal with COVID and whatever else he needs to do at the start while that's going on in the Senate? All very odd, but this is an extraordinary time, and it is my position. You didn't ask my position, but he has to be impeached, and he ought to be removed. This is prima facie evidence of fomenting insurrection that we saw on live television. That's all you need. You don't need a whole lot of testimony. Just look at what happened And the President of the United States encouraged, aided, and abetted, fomented that. So it is already an extraordinary circumstance, and we'll see some extraordinary processes as this goes along.
That was Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business and Politics, and John Brummett, a political columnist for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Today's conversation was part of a new program from Talk Business on the 2021 General Assembly. You can see and hear more from the inaugural episode at talkbusiness.net.
As President Trump faces another impeachment vote, he's leaving town to tout his accomplishments at the southern border. Immigration has been one of the biggest flashpoints of his presidency.
A nation without borders is not a nation.
We're going to have strong, incredible borders.
We're going to build the wall. We have no choice.
Trump's imprint on immigration policy this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered this afternoon from 3 until 6 on KUAF 91.3. The Arkansas Public Policy Center is located within the University of Arkansas System Division of Agriculture, and during the 2020 election, the center helped educate voters by sharing nonpartisan information about statewide ballot initiatives. While election season is over, the center's work isn't done.
It's always election season in Arkansas.
That's Kristen Higgins, Program Associate at the Public Policy Center.
And I say that because, you know, the legislative session will go into session. The General Assembly will start up in January, and that is when they actually start debating and proposed constitutional amendments for the 2022 election. So it's always happening. It doesn't stop.
Throughout the year, Higgins says the center shares information on its website or blog and then pushes that out through its social media channels. For example, at the beginning of the year, you may have seen a post about Arkansas's minimum wage increasing to $11 an hour effective January 1st as the result of a citizen-led ballot initiative.
I like to highlight anytime I can something that's tied to a ballot issue. And so for the past couple of years, every time there's been an update to the minimum wage, I will do a blog post or I will share information out on social media just saying, hey, do you remember this is happening and this is why? This is what prompted the wage increase. It's not just something that's randomly happening. It's something that voters decided. And I like to remind people of that because, you know, they get to see the impact of their vote.
Higgins says they want people to see that policies are tied to their votes. In the case of the state's new minimum wage, the increase is the result of Arkansas voters in November 2018 approving a citizen initiative ballot measure to increase the hourly minimum wage from $8.50 per hour to $11 per hour by 2021. In addition to periodically providing information about the phased implementation of this initiative, Higgins says they've also kept Arkansans apprised of other policies.
For example, there was another initiative a couple years ago. Actually, there was a constitutional amendment a couple years ago that created a citizens commission that would review state officials' pay, elected officials' pay, you know, at the state level and in the court systems. And they will periodically, you know, review salaries and increase those salaries. And so when that happens, we will share information as well, usually more on social media that says, hey, you know, you see this happening. And do you remember it's because voters approved it a couple of years ago?
The 2021 Arkansas legislative session officially began Monday, and the Public Policy Center has already shared some tips for how Arkansans can follow the session. The legislature has the ability to refer up to 3 constitutional amendments, so Higgins says they will be watching to see how that develops and provide information on that subject. Because officials have just collected data for the U.S. Census, Higgins says they will also be following redistricting efforts.
This is a once every decade thing where the lawmakers in Little Rock will have the ability to look at the census changes, the populations in Arkansas, and decide how U.S. House representative seat districts will be drawn. So we'll be looking at that, mostly just explaining the process that's used because it only happens once a decade. A lot of people aren't familiar with how it's done. And so just bringing that in front of people's attention. And also Governor, Attorney General, and Secretary of State will be responsible for drawing the district boundaries for our state legislators.
Redistricting will be front and center in 2021, Higgins says. So the Public Policy Center has created a page on its website dedicated to the topic. Whether Arkansas voters access the center's information through its website, blog, or social media channels, Higgins says the goal is simply to keep people involved and informed.
With the election over, you know, we always wonder, how can people stay engaged? How can we continue to keep people's attention? Because, I mean, we have information and we have a lot of dense information, but, and we try to write it in a way that most people can follow along and that might be interesting reading to them. But I just don't want people to lose that spark of interest that they had in the policies being set through an election season. And I just encourage people to keep looking for information, keep, you know, reading our website, follow us on social media, and just, you know, keep going, keep being interested and engaged.
More information is available at uaex.edu/PPC. We've spent a lot of time today looking forward to what the new legislative session might bring, so we thought now might be a good moment to pause and look backward. In this story from our archives, we travel back to the week in 1999 when the General Assembly opened for its regular session and Mike Huckabee was inaugurated as the governor of Arkansas. Ozarks at Large's Dan Bennett was in Little Rock at the time, covering the 82nd General Assembly, and he began his report with some sounds of the state capitol as it prepared for work.
Now, please come to order. Seats, please, those that have assigned seats. In accordance with the provisions of Article 5, Section 11 of the Arkansas Constitution, and by the authority vested in me by the rules of the Arkansas House of Representatives, Article 5, Section 16A, I, Tim Massanelli, declare the House of Representatives of the 82nd General Assembly to be officially convened.
Present.
Hall! I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States.
I, Bob Johnson, do solemnly swear.
I, Sharon Priest.
Do solemnly swear.
I, Mark Pryor.
Do solemnly swear.
I will support the Constitution.
I, Mike Huckabee, do solemnly swear.
I will support the Constitution.
Of the United States.
And the Constitution of the State of Arkansas.
And that I will faithfully discharge the duties.
Of the Office of Governor.
For the State of Arkansas.
Upon which I'm about to enter. So help me God.
After 2 days of ceremony, pomp, and fanfare, the 82nd General Assembly of Arkansas is ready for business. 1999 will be historic for the Assembly in several ways. There are 57 new members in the House, and though the legislature remains heavily Democratic, Republicans have made significant gains in state government. The governor and lieutenant governor are both Republicans, and the number of House Republicans doubled since 1997, with Northwest Arkansas sending 7 GOP members to Little Rock. One of them is 36-year-old Jeff Buchanan of Bella Vista.
I've been one of those who have a tendency to be called very conservative, but I do believe that there's a place for government. And we need to make a government, we need a government that's friendly to its citizens, not a foe. You know, we need some that people respect and say, yes, the government says we need to move in this area or move out of this area, and that makes sense. So we have to bring some credibility, I guess, back to the system.
Buchanan and his GOP colleagues could block some legislation with the help of a couple of conservative Democratic votes, but for now, the word in Little Rock is cooperation. Governor Mike Huckabee pledged as much in his inaugural address to a joint session of the General Assembly on Tuesday.
But I want to approach you today with a commitment that I may not agree with you on every issue, and I'm sure you won't agree with me on every one, but I will do my doggonest to treat you with the respect that you deserve by having been elected by the people of Arkansas to sit where you sit today. Sincerely pledging that I want to build a genuine relationship.
Huckabee outlined his agenda for the state in his 40-minute speech before the assembly, calling for property tax reform, a bond issue to fund highway repairs, and more streamlined government, among many other goals. Senate President Pro Tem Jay Bradford says at least one of Huckabee's goals, establishing a performance-based budget system, will be welcomed by Assembly Democrats.
That's a new concept. It's basically sweeping the United States, and I think it's absolutely, if it's properly administered, it's a very good concept. And what it really basically says is, if you have a program, we're going to measure it. If it does not come up to the proper level of performance, it's going to disappear. And I think that's good business, and I surely support that.
The governor also called for more money for higher education. But Sue Madison, a Democrat from Fayetteville, says the governor isn't going far enough.
Well, I hear a lot from university people, and they are concerned about the university's funding and how it will fare this session. And I think they're somewhat pessimistic that there's not going to be any large increases. In fact, we had to sort of go against the governor's recommendation. The governor was recommending very low level of increases for higher education. And we in subcommittee have recommended, and it has been adopted, that more money. I mean, when the governor projects that state revenue is going to grow 5-6% each year of the biennium and was only going to give about 3% to higher ed, we felt like they should at least get what is the growth.
Regular sessions of the General Assembly usually last about 90 days, but many fear this session could run longer because of all the new faces in Little Rock. However, the pledges by the governor and the House and Senate leadership to cooperate and compromise could keep the 82nd General Assembly on schedule, if everyone can keep their promises. For Ozarks at Large, from Little Rock, I'm Dan Bennett.
It's the Community Spotlight on KUAF. I'm Pete Hartman. Today on the line, again, Charity Jones with Tricycle Farms. This past giving season, the Giving Tree here at KUAF, which has been in effect for over a decade, benefiting nonprofits throughout the KUAF listening area, we benefited Tricycle Farms with non-perishable food items. They have a food distribution program that's been going on for four years or so, and that canned food, that non-perishable food, kind of bolstered the food that they recover from some different entities.
Well, thank you for having me, Pete. We were very happy to participate with the KUAF Giving Tree. We were able to collect 1,977 pounds of food. That comes to a value, an estimated value of about $7,906. So we raised almost 2,000 pounds of food worth almost $8,000, which was great.
I know as of now, y'all are working with Whole Foods. I believe also some stuff with Slim Chickens. But are y'all looking to have more places that you can go to recover this food?
Absolutely. We have reached out, yes, to several other entities to start recovering some food waste.
Charity Jones with Tricycle Farms. Again, the Giving Tree program this giving season almost got them 1 ton of non-perishable food items, which they then added to that recovered food each week and was just able to give a little more to some of these nonprofit and these groups in our area. Charity, somebody want to know more about what you guys do and maybe more importantly, how they can help out. What's the best way?
Well, our website is www.tricyclefarms.org. And then we're very active on social media, on Facebook and Instagram.
Charity Jones with Tricycle Farms. Charity, always nice speaking with you. And I'm so glad that our community could come through like they did and help you guys out. And in turn, y'all helped out so many others.
Well, thank you for the Giving Tree. And we were blessed to help others.
KUAF Public Radio is more than just a radio station. We are here to serve this community. 91.3 KUAF and the Community Spotlight. Local matters.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The Arkansas Story Vault was established in 2019 as a student-driven initiative of the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History and the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Arkansas Story Vault produces documentary projects rooted in the stories told by the people of Arkansas. In the spring of 2020, 5 undergraduate and graduate students started working on a series of short documentaries about the Northwest Arkansas Marshallese community. After the COVID-19 pandemic hit the state in March, the interns had to come up with a plan for completing their projects without shooting additional footage. The result is the Arkansas Atoll podcast. To learn more about the project, yesterday I spoke with 3 people who worked on it. Sarah K. Moore, a video producer at the Pryor Center, Colleen Thurston, an assistant professor of journalism and strategic media at the U of A, and Shane White, a graduate student and Arkansas Story Vault intern. Sarah began our conversation by explaining how they initially decided to focus on the Marshallese community for the project.
Our director, Bill Schwab, and geosciences professor Steve Boss had gotten National Science Foundation funding to host a conference at the Pryor Center in the summer of 2020 that was going to be covering the topic of climate change in the interior part of the country. And Bill really wanted to look at the Marshallese community in Northwest Arkansas and have that be one of the Story Vault student projects, because their homeland, I mean, they're from the Marshall Islands, obviously, and climate change is having an immediate, very real impact on them. And we were tasked with telling those stories. And the idea was that we would show some of these short documentaries as part of that conference. We began production on this, and very quickly into the production process, we had to switch gears.
Yeah, man, that feels like so long ago. So, we came in to the Arkansas Story Vault project, and we had really high hopes because the Marshallese community, there's been a lot of people and a lot of media outlets kind of try to tell their stories. And so we wanted to do something different and tell it from the voice of the Marshallese. And we worked with a lot of really prominent members in the Marshallese community, and we were able to get some on-site and really good interviews that talked about different things, starting from climate change and rising sea levels in the islands, how they migrated from the islands to here originally. We got into healthcare with one of the only professional Marshallese doctors around. And so it was just really eye-opening to get to talk with these members of the community and see what's really going on. So we were going to push out a mini-series, mini web series, just like the prior projects were. And we'd gotten a lot of interviews done. We were just kind of waiting on that supplemental footage, the things to go film, the opportunities to happen. And COVID hit. So we thought we were just going to be at a standstill for a while, just trying to pull together what little we had. And it wouldn't have been as good as it should have been. So we made the decision to pivot to making a podcast series, because we already had the voices, we just didn't have the visuals. So it made sense to move to that platform. And it just really took off, really getting into the editing and finding those stories within these really long, good interviews. And then we just, you know, we were allowed to go past the end of the semester. We worked through the summer, and now we've got a really good product that I think everyone's really proud of.
So the biggest shift in this project is going from video to just audio. And so Sarah and Colleen, I was curious, as 2 professional filmmakers, what were some of the challenges for you having your main medium kind of ripped away?
It was really exciting, I have to say, because, you know, Shane and the students, I think, Shane, it was your idea to do a podcast. And almost immediately, all of the rest of the students said yes. They got really excited. And as a filmmaker, I was more hesitant than they were, but hearing their enthusiasm, I immediately jumped on board. I was like, how do we do this? Let's do this. You know, it's kind of a common adage in documentary filmmaking that documentary is oftentimes audio with visuals edited over it. So you have to make sure that you have the story in an audio sense anyway. So I knew that they had the information, but Shane can elaborate on this. There was a lot of back and forth about how much do we make this hosted, how much of the student radio formats we're used to hearing some sort of host, but we really wanted to center the Marshallese voices. And so we were going back and forth a lot about thinking how we can do that and then still produce it as we're used to seeing and hearing in a podcast. So I was on board as soon as they were. Of course, coming from a production standpoint, you know, these folks are getting experience. They've all done a little bit of production, but of course, as emerging media makers, there's going to be some aspects that are just not perfectly polished. And so we dealt with that a little bit in terms of audio, right? That that may have been recorded into the camera versus into a Zoom or an audio recorder, right? But we also considered the times that we're in and how media consumption has changed because of the pandemic. Right now we're doing a Zoom interview for radio, for instance, and we're used to hearing things that are maybe a little less polished during this time. And so while we had the audio, we dealt with things like difference in room tones or recording narration that might not match, and I'm using quotation marks here, might not match the same audio from when the interview was given. Most of the audio that you hear was taken from video. Only a few additional interviews were given after the pandemic hit, and those were by phone. And those are identified as such in the podcast. But so they're using audio from video to cut down these podcasts, which is really unique and challenging, I'm sure, for the students. But I really admire their tenacity to go after it and say, let's work with what we have. And it took us a lot longer. But as Shane said, the product is there and it speaks for itself.
So if I have this right, there were 5 graduate and undergraduate students that worked on the project. Were any of them members of the Marshallese community? And if not, how did you go about getting those interviews? What was it like reaching out to a community that you weren't familiar with? Especially with, you know, the pandemic, we've learned a lot about mistrust specifically among health officials. So if there's a mistrust about, say, outsiders, how do you go in and ask for these people to tell stories, especially Shane, like you said, where you wanted to do something perhaps different than what you've seen in the media and let the Marshallese tell their own story?
Bill Schwab at the Pryor Center has been working on this kind of climate change symposium, and it had included a couple of the members of the Marshallese community, Benedict Madison and Chris Balos. And so they were kind of our initial contacts, but it was difficult because even with those contacts, we would get to these interviews and there would be times where one person would be like, you know, I'm just tired of telling the story because it seems like everybody tries to tell the story and nothing ever happens. And so we ran into those kind of barriers, and we just had to just slowly build trust with the community. And finally they saw that we were really trying to tell from their perspective and give their side of it. And so that knowledge and that proof was kind of really the only thing that allowed us in. It was really helpful having those two guys to begin with, but it was definitely a challenge because they're a very close-knit community to begin with, and letting outsiders in, especially with cameras in their faces, is just not something that they really felt like they wanted to do all the time.
And so to confirm, no students, no staff are Marshallese on this project, right?
No.
Right.
No.
So have you been able to show the Marshallese community the result of this project? And if so, what has their reaction been?
We did have a listening, what we call the listening party, once we had all of the episodes pretty much finalized. And we've tried really hard to get as many, obviously we wanted all of the people that participated in the podcast episodes to be present. Unfortunately, we only had, was it three members or just two members of the actual community? We had a very low response rate for that. But Benedict was one of the ones who was able to listen. And I think he had pretty good feedback. Shane and Colleen, you guys are welcome to join in on that. The biggest feedback we had was the climate change episode, and that was not from a member of the Marshallese community, if I'm correct. It was someone who works closely with the Marshallese community, and she felt like the main person that was profiled in that episode may not represent kind of the overall opinion or stance on that. And so we addressed that. The producer on that episode addressed the fact that you're hearing a single voice, a viewpoint in that particular episode.
I also want to point out that because the Marshallese community is so hard hit right now, we tried to be considerate in what we were asking of them. One of the families that was interviewed lost one of their family members during the course of this production. So trying to be considerate and knowing that we are outsiders to the community and not push any kind of emotional weight or ask of that much from the community. At the same time, sharing what we've done and asking for feedback, but also not expecting or asking of them to do additional work for us when they have a lot going on. And I don't want to speak for anyone from the Marshallese community, but we're trying to be conscientious about that emotional weight and still fair in how we do share their stories, because these are their stories and it's their community, and they've let us share them, and we're trying to do the best possible, take the best possible approach that we can to share their perspectives. But you know, now at this time, it feels trite, I guess, to say, hey, we made this podcast. Can you take some time and listen to several hours and tell us, you know, if it's okay? And we want feedback, but at the same time, I'm not sure that listening to a podcast is a lot of folks' priority at this moment. We want people too, and we're hoping that it can amplify the voices of this community. We're hoping to also, you know, have made some partnerships that can be sustainable down the road. We'd love to work with the Marshallese community. We'd love to bring on interns from the community to share their stories, their voices, their perspectives. But to answer your question, it's a hard time right now. And I think we all kind of agreed to be considerate of how we're working with the community from here on out.
What are some of the lessons that you've learned from this project, either from a production standpoint or from maybe something that you've learned about this community that you weren't familiar with before?
Really, the lesson that was just kind of enforced in my own mind throughout this time is that there's so many ways to tell a story, and there are better ways than others to tell particular stories. And so it was a really good learning experience on how to take something and turn it into something totally different and see how it works. Because honestly, I mean, I thought it worked really good. And I kind of took a book from one of Arkansas's own, one of the podcasts, American Jihadi. They worked for a long time trying to make that a film. And finally they decided this is podcast material. And so that was what inspired me to do this. So it was really cool to take that inspiration and put it into effect and watch how that played out. I learned everything about the Marshallese community, but I learned that they are a very close and respectful and loyal community. And it was really great to be allowed in to their lives and to get to know them. And then just making a podcast was a huge lesson itself. So that was the first time any of us had ever done that. And it really prepared me to make a second one. And I just felt like I grew through the entire process.
I think it's really important to acknowledge the collaboration that we had and the trust from the Marshallese community and thank them for sharing their stories and for allowing us to share them.
That was Sarah K. Moore, a video producer at the Pryor Center, Colleen Thurston, an assistant professor of journalism and strategic media at the U of A, and Shane White, a graduate student and Arkansas Story Vault intern. We spoke yesterday afternoon. All six episodes of the Arkansas Atoll podcast, as well as an introduction and conclusion, are available at storyvault.uark.edu.
The Kiva NWA Hub is a local, community-based lending program and a branch of Kiva US. This program expands access to microloans, which help entrepreneurs in Northwest Arkansas develop and thrive. These non-conventional loans are for disadvantaged area business owners and sole proprietors. Applicants and lenders interested in supporting area business borrowers can learn more at kiva-nwa.org.
This is 91.3 FM in Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Springdale, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas. Contributors today included Susanna Sitek and Pete Hartman, as well as Roby Brock from Talk Business and Politics and John Brummett from the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Thanks also to our partner station KUAR in Little Rock, who shared sounds from the first day of the Arkansas legislative session. Thank you to Timothy Dennis for mixing and mastering today's show. Our theme song is written and performed by Daryl Sean. On tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large, we'll have highlights from Governor Asa Hutchinson's State of the State address, which he delivered this morning. We'll also have the latest on the pandemic, including a story about an effort to vaccinate hundreds of University of Arkansas Fort Smith students that began Monday. One programming note, the U.S. House of Representatives is expected to debate the article of impeachment that's been brought against the president tomorrow morning. KUAF will broadcast NPR's live coverage of the debate beginning at 8 a.m. There's a chance the proceedings may last through the noon hour, thereby preempting our midday edition of Ozarks at Large. However, we still expect to have our 7 p.m. edition Wednesday evening. As always, you can catch up on past editions of the show and previously aired stories at our website, ozarksatlarge.com. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you have a terrific rest of your Tuesday.